From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, why prisons have become a booming business, even though the rate of violent crime is falling. We talk with Eric Schlosser about his article, The Prison Industrial Complex. It's the cover story of the current edition of The Atlantic Monthly. He says that special interests are leading us to build more prisons regardless of the actual need. Then Vivian Stern discusses her study of prisons around the world. She's a senior research fellow at the International Center for Prison Studies at King's College in England. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new Miles Davis reissue, The Complete Bitches Brew Sessions. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Incoming House Speaker Bob Livingston is acknowledging that the impeachment investigation of President Clinton may not be finished before the end of the year, but he says he hopes it will be. At a news conference today, Livingston said it's too early to make any decisions about whether the House should consider a censure of the president as an alternative to impeachment. The president has asked senior advisors to make recommendations to him next month on whether convicted spy Jonathan Pollard should be granted clemency. Pollard's release was sought by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu as a last-minute condition of the Middle East peace talks at Y River, Maryland. Mr. Clinton made no promises at that time, but agreed to take a fresh look at the issue. Pollard is serving a life sentence for espionage. The scheduled pre-dawn launch of the space shuttle Endeavour was postponed today because of a technical problem. NASA will try again tomorrow. Pat Duggins of member station WMFE reports.
Bad weather threatened to postpone the liftoff attempt, but in the end, it was a master alarm inside the shuttle's cockpit that ruined the blastoff. Moments after the astronauts switched on Endeavour's hydraulic power system, sensors showed a drop in pressure. The onboard equipment appeared to be fine, but launch controllers seemed to argue over whether it was a real problem or not.
We are go for launch.
ISO concurs.
NSPE. ISO feel comfortable that it was a hydraulic and it was because of the system starting up.
Got to pick it up, NTD.
Okay,
what's up? TLS, pick up the count on your mark.
By then, there wasn't enough time for the countdown to tick to zero and keep within Endeavour's short launch window. The tight liftoff opportunity is so the astronauts can catch up with the orbiting Zarya module. For NPR News, I'm Pat Duggins in Orlando.
School officials in Boston are planning to ask the U.S. Supreme Court to decide whether race can be a factor in admissions to the city's top academic high schools. From member station WBUR in Boston, Jason Beaubien has more.
Boston school officials say they're appealing the case of Sarah Westman because they want to determine whether Boston Latin's admissions policy is constitutional. Currently, the city uses race as a factor in admitting some students to its three elite exam schools. Westman, who is white, was passed over for a slot at Boston Latin despite having higher scores than 11 minority students who were admitted. Last month, a federal appeals court ruled that the race-based portion of the admissions policy is unconstitutional and ordered that Westman be accepted at Boston Latin. School officials say they're simply trying to ensure diversity at the city's top public high schools. They say they'll attempt to defend the affirmative action program before the high court. For NPR News, I'm Jason Beaubien in Boston.
A new report by the group Human Rights Watch says the Clinton administration has large blind spots regarding human rights. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 83 points in heavy trading, but on the NASDAQ, it's a different picture. The composite index is now up 5 points. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, today marks the third down day this week for the stock market. Investor concerns about earnings and a surprise interest rate cut by Germany are affecting the market action today, as NPR's Jack Spear reports.
Global investors were caught by surprise by the decision by Germany's central bank to trim rates, a move that was quickly followed by the other major European countries today. In announcing the cut, officials with the Bundesbank cited continued concerns about the state of the world economy. In the U.S., the government meanwhile announced, despite the state of the world economy, things didn't look so bad here during the summer months. Labor Department reports productivity of American workers rose 3% at an annual rate for the third quarter. The nation's major retailers reported November sales numbers today. They were mixed, and GM, the nation's biggest automaker, says its November sales fell 5.6%. Ford says sales rose 1.3% last month. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
Top Republican leaders in Congress are pledging to work toward shoring up the Social Security system, providing more jobs for Americans, and cutting taxes in the next session of Congress that begins in January. Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott says GOP lawmakers want to make sure that the country has a fairer, simpler tax code. Lott says he will push for an across-the-board cut in tax rates. Boeing may be singing the blues, but Europe's Airbus industry says it is confident that the market for its commercial aircraft will keep expanding. The Asian financial crisis has had a bigger impact on Boeing, which depends on those markets for sales of its jumbo jets, while Airbus sells smaller aircraft that can be flown profitably on long routes with fewer passengers. Boeing announced this week that it's scaling back production and that it will cut up to 20,000 more jobs. I'm Craig Windham, National Public Radio News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music, offering a world to explore through books and music. Location information, 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The prison industry is booming. My guest, Eric Schlosser, examines why in his article, The Prison Industrial Complex. It's the cover story of the December edition of The Atlantic Monthly. Schlosser is a journalist who previously joined us to talk about the business of pornography. He says the prison industrial complex isn't a conspiracy. It's a set of bureaucratic, political, and economic interests that encourage increased spending on imprisonment, regardless of the actual need. I asked Schlosser what special interests are part of the prison industrial complex.
Well, from a political point of view, it's both liberal and conservative politicians who, for the last 20 years, have used the fear of crime to gain votes, and have really played to people's fears and anxieties. In terms of the bureaucratic interests, it's the departments of correction, which, like any bureaucracy, have a built-in motive to grow. And in terms of economic interests, it's poor rural areas who have seen prisons as a very good way of fueling economic growth. Oddly enough, in some areas, as military bases have closed, they've been replaced by new prisons. I visited Fort Dix in New Jersey, and on part of the base where they used to have barracks for the Army, they now have prisoners. The economic interests are also the companies that are now involved in the prison industry. About 15 years ago, the total value of spending on prisons in this country was about $8 billion. And now it's about $35 to $40 billion. That's a big market. So whether it's the phone companies or the big construction companies or architecture firms and plumbing supply companies, there are now huge conventions every year for the prison industry. And this just didn't exist a generation ago.
I don't want to dwell too much on statistics, but the numbers do show that there is a prison boom. What are some of the most interesting statistics you found in your research that show the growth in prisons now?
Well, the thing that I found most stunning is that the United States has almost 2 million citizens locked up behind bars, and that's more than any other country in the world, and it's about 500,000 more than Communist China. It's just a staggering figure. You imagine the combined populations of Atlanta, St. Louis, Pittsburgh, Des Moines, Miami behind bars. And this is a very recent phenomenon. In the early 1970s, there were only about 200,000 people in the United States behind bars. California has more than that right now in its prisons and jails.
Now, since 1991, you say the rate of violent crime in the U.S. has fallen by about 20%, but the number of people in jail or prison has risen by about 50%. What are some of the different explanations for that?
Well, again, I think that once the laws were put in place, the mandatory minimum drug sentences and the laws that got rid of parole and judges began giving longer sentences, there was this mechanism in place that was going to continue growing the prison system regardless of the rate of violent crime. One of the things that people need to remember is that most of the people who are being sent away each year are not violent offenders. And when it comes to violent offenders, like murderers and rapists and violent armed robbers, few people would argue that these people should be wandering the streets. But two-thirds of the people who are being sent to prison every year are nonviolent offenders. And that's where most of the growth in the prison population has come from. And I think it's very important to keep in mind who we're talking about when we're talking about the prison system in this country in terms of who the inmates are. Because if you look at this as a prison industrial complex, the inmates are the raw material of this industry. And it's very disturbing who we're locking up.
So the prison population is booming. Has the population itself changed? In other words, the people in the prison population?
Well, it has changed in the sense that the proportion of inmates who are African American has really risen. And now a slight majority of the inmates in this country are African American. What's changed is the arrest rate of African American men for drug crimes. Black men and white men use illegal drugs at about the same rate, but black men are 5 times more likely to be sent to prison for a drug crime than white men are. And as a result, you have one out of the odds that a black man in the United States will be sent to prison now is about 1 in 4. And in some states in the United States, Florida, for example, 1 out of every 4 African-American men can no longer vote because of having been sent to prison. The inmate population is poor. About 70% of the inmates are illiterate. About 60 to 80% are substance abusers. And a very large number of the prison inmates in this country are seriously mentally ill. They're the kind of people who a generation ago would have been in mental institutions. But because of the deinstitutionalization of the mentally ill in the 70s and 80s, they're now locked up in prison receiving very little care. I'm talking about manic depressives, paranoid schizophrenics. And the United States is unusual in using its prison system to deal with seriously mentally ill people. There are also a lot of women in prison. Of the women in prison, about 70% are nonviolent offenders. About 75% have children. And all told right now, there are about 1 to 2 million children in America who have at least one parent in prison. And that has very dangerous implications because when you look at who's most likely to be sent to prison, studies have found that someone who has had a parent in prison is statistically far more likely to be sent to prison. So we are creating perhaps a cycle of incarceration by locking up this many parents.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Eric Schlosser, and he has the cover story in the December edition of the Atlantic Monthly on the prison industrial complex. Now, you write a little bit about who's prospering from the prison boom: construction firms, plumbing supply companies, food service programs, some health companies. The phone companies are doing very well in the prisons. Now, why are prisons good customers for phone companies?
Well, they're unlikely to be able to change their long-distance carriers, and phone calls are really their main, one of their main links to the outside world, and it's a booming business. I mean, when you have nearly 2 million people locked up, they make a lot of phone calls. Quite frequently, they make collect calls, and the phone companies are now adding a surcharge to each call, sometimes as high as $3 a call. So it's now a business of about $1 billion a year. Each of the major phone companies has set up its own special prison service. AT&T has something called the Authority. MCI has something called Maximum Security. And in MCI's case, they installed phones throughout much of the California prison system for free, just as a way of getting a good cut of the business.
Would you describe a couple of the phone ads directed at prisoners?
Yeah, well, they've put together some very glossy, expensive promotional material for their prison phone services. One of them is a black and white photograph on a pamphlet that shows an inmate, scary-looking inmate, leaning out of a prison cell, glaring at the camera. And the tagline goes, "How he got in is your business. how he gets out is ours. And then it says AT&T, the authority. And Bell South has for its Max service an ad with a telephone receiver that has a heavy steel chain dangling from it instead of a cord. So there is really direct marketing and mass marketing and a lot of money being spent on the ad budgets for these services. It's a big business now.
Did you look at any of the other catalogs advertising to the prisons?
Well, there are trade publications now that just cater to this industry, and they're full of ads. There are padded cells available in a vast color selection. There are all kinds of trade names for razor wire. One of my favorites is Silent Swordsman Barbed Tape. And the same kind of marketing and American advertising promotion that's applied to mundane products is now being applied to even things like electrified fences, which are being advertised with the tagline, "Don't touch."
If you're just joining us, my guest is Eric Schlosser, and he has the cover story in this month's Atlantic Monthly called The Prison Industrial Complex. Eric, let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Eric Schlosser, and he wrote a story on the prison industrial complex. It's the cover story in this month's Atlantic Monthly. You say that private prisons are both the most controversial and the fastest-growing segment of the prison industrial complex. Why are they the fastest-growing segment?
Well, they're the fastest-growing segment because they promise less expensive incarceration to the states that use them, and large profits to the investors who invest in them and to the people who go to work for them. In the early 1980s, there were no private prisons in this country, and now there are about 90,000 inmates being housed in private prisons. It's not a new idea. During the 19th century, there were private prisons, and most of them, almost all of them, were shut down because of the incredible corruption and the abuse of inmates that occurred. A private prison has a built-in economic interest in having as many inmates as possible and keeping them as long as possible, because that's how they make their money.
What made it possible for private prisons to open beginning in the mid-80s?
Well, during the Reagan administration, there was a real push towards smaller government and towards a privatization of public services. So on a very small level, there were the beginnings of private prisons in the late 1980s. And it really was in the early 1990s that it took off because of prison overcrowding in a number of states, and they were desperate to put their inmates anywhere, but also because the Clinton administration gave a real seal of approval to private prisons by shifting more federal inmates towards them.
In your Atlantic magazine piece, you compare the prison industry to the hotel industry in that they both have financial incentives to keep beds filled. Do the prisons get paid per filled bed?
Well, the pricing is based on man days. And a man day is one inmate per day in the prison. The price of a man day is $25 to $60 a day. And the more crowded the prison gets, the lower they'll charge for each additional inmate. It's similar to the hotel industry in that the labor costs are a major, major part of the total costs. In prisons, the labor costs, that is to pay the guards and the staff, is about two-thirds to three-quarters of their total costs. So the more inmates they can put in each prison, the labor costs come down relatively from there. And that's why most of the savings that the private prisons derive is from paying their staff members less money. And I think that's a very important point that isn't really looked at very often in the debate over private prisons. Very few people would argue on behalf of paying other law enforcement officers, like police officers, less money. But the private prison industry has really thrived by paying its guards and correctional officers lower salaries and by not paying them pensions.
I want to get to the idea of filling beds. You say that there are bed brokers who actually work on commission to fill beds in prisons. How does that part of the business work?
Well, bed brokers are a whole new line of work.
Is that what they're actually called, or is that what you named
them? That's what they're called.
That's
what they're called. They're called bed brokers. And if you want to continue with a hotel analogy, they are the travel agents of the prison industry. When a state prison system has too many inmates and needs to house some of them in a private prison but doesn't know where to find a bed, they contact a bed broker. And the bed broker serves as the liaison between the state agency and the private prison. And in return for finding some place to put their prisoners, the bed broker gets a fee of anywhere from $2.50 a day to $5.50 a day for having placed an inmate in a prison. Now, one of the most surreal facts that's come out of this whole private prison boom is Texas has really become the headquarters of the private prison industry in terms of the number of beds. And the state of Hawaii has been shipping large numbers of its inmates to Texas. And one prison in Texas, the Newton County Correctional Facility in Newton County, Texas, became the state of Hawaii's third largest prison in 1996 because of how many inmates were being flown halfway across the world to be locked up in a little rural Texan prison.
Is there any government regulation that helps determine where prisoners are sent?
At the moment, there is very little. In terms of the transportation of inmates, there are tougher federal laws about the transportation of cattle than there are of prisoners. Most of these shipments of prisoners on land are being done in vans and station wagons that are deliberately housing fewer than a dozen inmates in order to avoid interstate commerce laws on transportation companies. So there are very few regulations right now in the transport of inmates. Violent inmates and violent offenders are very often being transported back and forth across this country by private companies with very unskilled drivers and guards. In terms of how the states are regulating the private prisons that are located within their jurisdiction, Texas has changed its laws and has, you know, added some greater regulation because a few years ago they realized that about 240 sex offenders were being housed in a prison that they thought was just holding illegal immigrants. And when a few of them escaped, they were unable to prosecute the escapees for having escaped because they had run away from a private prison. So Texas has now made it illegal to escape from a private prison. But many other states have not passed that sort of law. And a number of states that have private prisons not only have no control over what inmates are being brought into their state, but often don't know what inmates and what sort of violent offenders are being held in their private prisons.
Who decides whether a prisoner will do time in a private or state-run facility?
The state agency, or now the federal correctional agency, decides it. And they do it on the basis of where they have room to put their inmates. The private prison industry really arose as a response to the gigantic growth in the prison population. And state agencies were overwhelmed. As I mentioned, about 45 of the 50 states are overcrowded. So they do it on the basis of where they have room to put the inmate and how they'd like to house their inmates in a general sense in terms of cost. Private prisons promise a less expensive form of incarceration, although it's not actually clear that they ultimately deliver on it.
I think some people have a theory that the prison boom is helping to create more demand. the more beds that there are, the more prisoners that there are to fill the beds.
I think that the demand is fueling the extra beds at the moment. At the same time, there have been about 1,000 new prisons and jails built in the last 16 or 17 years. This is a huge capital investment. And now that we have big private prison companies with big capital investment in prisons, they have an interest in keeping their beds filled. One Wall Street report by Wall Street Bank on the private prison industry said that some of the risks of the private prison industry would be that there would be a fall in crime, that there would be a move towards alternative sentences for drug offenders, or that there'd be some changes in the nation's drug laws so that there'd be fewer inmates in the future. This was Wall Street's evaluation of the risks of the prison industry, but ultimately this investment bank still thought it was a good place to invest.
Eric Schlosser's article, The Prison Industrial Complex, is the cover story of the current Atlantic Monthly. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
For tapes or transcripts of Fresh Air, please call toll-free anytime, 1-888-NPR-NEWS. Also, Fresh Air interviews are now available online at www.audible.com/freshair.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Eric Schlosser about the prison industrial complex. Vivian Stern discusses her study of prisons around the world. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new Miles Davis reissue, The Complete Bitches Brew Sessions. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with journalist Eric Schlosser. His article on the prison boom, called The Prison Industrial Complex, is the cover story of the current edition of The Atlantic Monthly. California builds and operates the biggest prisons in the U.S. Its three strikes, you're out law has been helping keep the prisons filled. California added 8 new maximum security prisons between the years 1984 and 94. You visited a prison in California that's been nicknamed New Folsom. What's different about New Folsom compared to the other prisons in California?
Well, New Folsom is one of eight or nine maximum security prisons in California. It's considered a level 4 facility with the most violent offenders in the system, and also people with the longest sentences, with a third strike or a life sentence, who are at high risk of escape. I think the most significant thing that I took away from my visit was how overcrowded it is. When you have a maximum security prison like that, double bunking is very dangerous. Basically, that means having two inmates in each cell. And the tensions within the California prison system are at a very high level. They have an enormous number of gang members from every sort of gang that you can imagine, and the prisons are stretched to their breaking point simply by how many people have been crammed into them.
I think that this prison, the one known as New Folsom, has an electric fence around it, one of the new high-tech fences that's used as maximum security. How does that work? What's it like?
Well, the electrified fences that California's maximum security prisons now have deliver a lethal dose of electricity when they're touched, 5,000 volts, and they instantly kill whoever touches them. And oddly enough, they were a response to the enormous cost of this prison building boom. By having one of these electrified fences around a maximum security prison, the California Department of Correction was able to get rid of having guards in guard towers watching the perimeter. And as a cost-saving measure, they've simply put up these fences that are lethal. So far, no inmate has been killed by one, but they're a very ominous development. And so far, I don't think that any other state has put up one of these death wire electrified fences around its facilities.
Are these electric fences controversial within the prison industry?
Well, they have been controversial in the prison world. At first, they were controversial because so many birds were being killed by them. And they had to figure out a way to put netting around them in order to protect migrating birds. They've been controversial among some prison rights activists who say this is capital punishment for trying to escape. Inmates trying to escape have traditionally been shot by guards or shot at by guards, so it's not necessarily that more people are being killed, but there's something viscerally about the idea of this gigantic, deadly fence that indiscriminately kills anyone who touches it, that it just has an ominous aura to it.
How has new high technology devices like these death wire fences affected the role of guards at prisons?
Well, in some cases, and especially in the private prison, new private prisons, the design of the prisons is such as to minimize labor costs, to basically look after as many inmates as possible with as few guards as possible. So the new prisons tend to have central control booths with cells around them in a semicircle, and it permits a single guard to operate cell doors electronically, and it cuts down on labor costs. But there are others in corrections who believe that it's very important that correctional officers and inmates work in close proximity, and that correctional officers be in constant dialogue with inmates, and that that is a more effective way, ultimately, of overseeing inmates and preventing disturbances and preventing inmates from harming one another. It's a more expensive route because you have to pay more correctional officers to be on duty. One of the problems with these electric doors is sometimes they don't work, or sometimes inmates figure out a way to jam them. But on the whole, I think much of the new technology has been useful. At the same time, things like the electrified fence are a little bit more disturbing.
There's a debate about whether this growth in private prisons is a good thing. Can you give us a sense of what the debate is on each side?
Well, there's an ethical debate, and then there's also a more practical debate. The ethical debate is, should we be handing over custody of individuals to private companies who have an enormous power over their lives and have a vested interest in keeping them locked up? So that's the ethical argument. Some people would argue that government should take responsibility for looking after the people who have broken the government's laws. And then from a purely practical point of view, does it save money? And it's not entirely clear that it does save money. The other point would be, if it saves money in the short term, is it less costly per day to keep an inmate in there? Well, what about the long-term implications? There is an enormous recidivist rate among inmates, and ideally, when you lock people up, you would like to release them less likely to come back to prison. So I guess those are the two questions, an ethical question and then also a practical one.
I guess the results aren't really in yet on some of the practical questions, because the private prisons haven't been around long enough to really have long-term statistics on recidivism, for instance.
That's right. But I guess one of the other critiques of private prisons is that many of the people who are being sent to them shouldn't be sent to prison at all. I mean, one of the things that we haven't discussed is drug treatment and how the United States is unusual in locking up drug offenders as opposed to giving them treatment. And that's a very large proportion of the prison population. And the private prisons tend to have fewer violent offenders and more nonviolent offenders like drug offenders or drug offenders who are committing property crimes in order to buy drugs.
You've described how America has proportionately more prisoners than any other country. A lot of the prisoners in American prisons now are people who have been convicted of drug offenses. What are some of the alternatives to imprisonment that other countries are using for drug offenders?
Well, not only are a lot of the people in American prisons people who've committed drug offenders, but as I mentioned, 60 to 80% of them are substance abusers. So even if they've committed a burglary and are in there for a burglary, it was a property crime to buy drugs. Other countries, as a first line of defense, tend to use drug treatment and alternative sentences for people who have substance abuse problems. And one of the extraordinary things that's happened in this country, while we've been building more prisons, is that the number of drug treatment slots has dropped by 50% in the last 5 years. So of the drug-addicted and substance-abusing inmates that we have in this country, only one out of every 10 have any access to drug treatment. There was a study recently by the RAND Corporation, which is hardly a bastion of liberalism, that suggested that putting an inmate in drug treatment is 10 to 15 times more cost-effective than using mandatory minimum sentences and tough sentences to lock them up. Effective not only in the number of crimes it prevents, but the money that it saves. So I guess that's one of the ways in which the United States has really followed an unusual course.
Well, give us an example of something that surprised you a lot that you learned during your research on this piece on the prison industrial complex.
I guess the most surprising thing for me was how big our prison system is and how unusual that is compared to any other country. It's a very distinctively American reaction to crime to lock people up. And when you look at just the state of California, the state of California has more inmates than France, Great Britain, Germany, Japan, Singapore, and the Netherlands combined. Other countries have found other ways to deal with dysfunctional people or drug offenders or people who are breaking laws. And the United States, more than any other country, believes itself to be a citadel of liberty and the land of the free. And there is this extraordinarily bizarre contradiction that we have this enormous prison system. So I guess the thing that really struck me and that I still think about is this unusual American trait for locking people up.
Well, Eric Schlosser, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Eric Schlosser's article, The Prison Industrial Complex, is the cover story of the current Atlantic Monthly. Coming up, a study of prisons around the world. This is Fresh Air. My guest Vivian Stern has written a new book about prisons around the world. She says she wants to examine who ends up in the prisons of the world and who works in them, and she wants to expose the waste, the horror, and the heroism within the growing incarceration business. Stern is senior research fellow at the International Center for Prison Studies at King's College in England and secretary general of Penal Reform International. She lives in London. I asked her to compare the prison rates in America to the prison rates in European democracies.
The way we measure imprisonment rates in our world is per 100,000 of the population. So we look at everybody's imprisonment rate in relation to that. And of course, in those terms, the United States is in an extraordinary position. The average for the Western European democracies is about 80, maybe 80 to 90. And in the United States, we're talking about 645 per 100,000, which is, of course, the second highest in the world after Russia. And Russia, being a European country and now a member of the Council of Europe, is working very hard to bring its prison population down and has started reductions, whereas in the United States so far, for the last 20 years, we've seen a steady increase every year, and it's still running at 5% per year increase.
Of all the prisons that you toured in your travels around the world, which did you consider the most effective and humane?
Africa, for instance, is very interesting. Because in Africa, of course, prison was not part of the culture. And an African who's had a crime committed against him or her doesn't think, right, I want that person to suffer. I want the person to go to prison. They think, right, I need some redress. I'm entitled to something back for this, and I'm entitled to some recompense for this affront to my dignity or my family or my property. And what's the use of prison? If the person goes away, I've got nothing, and probably the person's wife and family are left here, and somebody's got to do their bit to help them to survive. So I think basically, if you go to prisons in Africa, you do see a very different attitude between staff and prisoners. I'm not saying that Africa doesn't have its share of brutality, because you only have to think of what's happened there in the last few years. But in terms of imprisonment, you will see a prison where staff and prisoners are very considerate of each other, where there's hardly any security at all, where you can have 5 staff and 900 prisoners and no fear and no atmosphere and no tension. So in a sense, in terms of relationships, prisons in Africa have got something to teach us. In terms of concern for prisoners' rights, I think you want to look at some of the countries in Western Europe, like Scandinavia, where prisoners are entitled to complain and where there are quite a high level of protections. But I have to say that overall in the world, it's very difficult to maintain humanity in a setting where one group of people have been given complete power over another group of people.
I'm surprised to hear you say that you saw good things in African prisons. I would have thought, though, that a lot of the prisons were the outgrowths of the colonial system and that there were very, very problematic power relationships being expressed inside.
that doesn't seem to be the case. The buildings are left over from the colonists. The uniforms, they often look like British. The rules of the prison were written 40, 50 years ago by the British. But the way the prisons are run is much more in accordance with African ideas that, in a sense, if people are their brothers, then they're their brothers, and they would treat them as such. And there is a concern to get the prisoners fed, and there is an absence of violence, there's an absence of hatred, and there seems to be a mutual respect. In many countries of the world, the staff look down on the prisoners. They don't necessarily despise them, they look down on them. Certainly in Africa, you get a feeling of, this could have been me, this unfortunate person who's ended up in prison could easily have been me. And there isn't that sense of hatred and contempt that you see in other parts of the world.
I think in the United States, a lot of prisons have come to be seen as schools for crime, where you could, in other words, go in for a petty crime and end up being really educated in how to commit more violent, high-powered crimes. Is that a typical feeling in other countries, that prisons are schools for crimes?
The institution of prison is a very strange one, if you begin to think about it. We want people to stop being criminals, so we send them to a place where all the other people are criminals. And we expect out of that experience them to learn not to be criminals. But of course, what happens is the opposite. A subculture is created, not only a criminal subculture, but also, in a sense, a victim subculture. All of us in here are poor things. We are all victims. We didn't really do what they said we did. So it creates certainly a school for crime. And in a sense, what's worse is the denial of the fact that you did something wrong. That is what prison cultivates. And one of the reasons why I think it's an institution we should start be asking some questions about. Is this really how we want to deal with people who've committed crime? Because in a sense, it imposes enormous suffering in one way, but another way, it lets them off the hook.
Lets them off the hook how?
They never have to think about their victim. They are, in a sense, absolved from having to make any redress to the victim. Because the saying goes, once you've done your prison sentence, you have paid your debt to society. So it lets people off the hook in beginning to think about who they are, what they did, why are they the sort of person that did what they did, and do they want to live the rest of their lives like this? None of that goes on in prison.
Have you seen in any of the countries that you've toured and studied any good alternatives to prison for offenders?
There are many ways in which you can deal with crime other than prison. And certainly all that prison really does is protect you from people who are dangerous and who might go on doing it again. But it doesn't solve anything. So I think what we need to look at is those alternatives that try and solve the problem and which try and do something for the victim. New Zealand is a very interesting case where they have been drawing on the culture of the indigenous people in New Zealand, that is Maori people, who have always felt that with crime there should be restoration to the victim, redress, and an attempt to awake in the offender a sense of conscience and a sense of shame. And certainly with all their young people now, they have a system called family group conferencing, where the young offender is brought face to face with a large number of people with an interest, the victim, victim's family, the offender, the offender's family, people from the community, to talk about what sort of a young person you are. Why did you do it? How could you have done such a thing? And try and educate, in the best sense, into sympathising with another person and then doing something over many weeks, perhaps, to make up to the victim for what they've done.
Well, Vivian Stern, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Vivian Stern is the author of A Sin Against the Future, Imprisonment in the World. Coming up, a review of the Miles Davis reissue, The Complete Bitches Brew Sessions. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says trumpeter Miles Davis had an infinite capacity for reinventing his music, usually to good ends. That's one reason why no one in jazz has had so many thorough and loving reissues lately. Earlier this year, we had a box set of airy and lyrical acoustic jazz by his celebrated 60s quintet. Last year, there were 5 double CD sets of his dense jazz funk of the 70s. Kevin says the new Miles Davis reissue, the complete Bitches Brew Sessions on 4 CDs, sort of bridges those two periods. It's a portrait of music in transition.
Easy to hear why Bitches Brew sold nearly 500,000 copies on first release in 1970. Its electric colors were still new to jazz, and it had a bubbling groove that sounded like it could go on forever. And it did. For years, Miles Davis had been pulling jazz away from the gymnastics of improvising over complex chord sequences. Bitches Brew was a last step along that path. 20-minute jams on just one or two chords where the musicians could place their comments anywhere in time, creating a polyrhythmic soup. It was a step away from bebop and toward African music in spirit, if not actual sound. That's Benny Maupin on bass clarinet and Chick Corea and Joe Zawinul on electric pianos. After some urging from Columbia Records, Miles Davis had decided to pursue the big money rock stars were making. He was seduced by the same false logic that misled other jazz musicians. Since we know more about music than the rockers, we can make even bigger selling pop records. It never worked out that way. Bitches Brew was a super funky bestseller for jazz, but it neither outsold nor outfunked, say, Sly and the Family Stone. Wayne Shorter on soprano sax, Lenny White and Jack DeJohnette on drums. Bitches Brew had some of the trappings of modern rock. The two-chord jam concept was familiar from Neil Young's Down by the River, also recorded in 1969. And Miles' guitarist, a newcomer from England named John McLaughlin, was for sure a better picker than Neil. But the music was too amorphous for radio pop. Rock involves simple forms, but not the absence of form. And jamming on one chord is more limiting than true free improvisation, which at least allows the possibility of escape. This was more like making sausage. You can keep extruding it endlessly to divide up later. That's Pharaoh's Dance from the August 1969 sessions for Bitches Brew. The reissue of that old 2-LP set runs to 4 CDs, tacking on material from 5 more Miles Davis sessions over the next 6 months. Almost an hour and a half of it is newly released. On the later sessions, there's a bit more structure to hang the improvising on, little sonic anchors like the recurring hooks in pop songs. Some of these tunes have as many as 3 chords, but the overall effect remained too diffuse for airplay. The focus stayed on exotic instrumental colors, with Indian sitar and tambora used as window dressing. These sessions also preview the most tiresome fashion accessory in 70s jazz, the add-on percussionist, armed with shakers, scrapers, clackers, and the dreaded chime rack. Miles's man was Brazil's Ayrton Moreira, who instantly became the king of percussion. This is Miles's take on David Crosby's Guinevere. Some folks claim producer and tape editor Teo Macero was the real brains behind Miles' music in this period. That idea is shot down by a bit of studio chatter included in the box as an editorial comment.
Okay, is this going to be part two?
It's going to be part nine. What difference does it make?
Right. There we go. Stand by. This is part something.
Some musicians on these dates, notably Joe Zawinul, have insisted they were the real creative forces at work. Miles Davis, as usual, gave his side folk lots of room to create and gave himself a little too much composer credit. But also, as usual, he showed a genius for editing other folks' compositions to make them more simple and clear, like Count Basie, by the way. Musicians came and went, but Miles followed his own path. In the next few years, his music evolved into the rhythmically denser, shifting plates of sound heard on Miles Davis at Fillmore and Dark Magus, and other wah-wah funk records that lots of us hated then and love now. Those records, to these ears anyway, wear a little bit better than Bitches Brew.
Kevin Whitehead is the author of New Dutch Swing. He reviewed the Miles Davis reissue, The Complete Bitches Brew Sessions, on Columbia. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Roberta Shurrock, with Monique Nazareth and Anne-Marie Baldonado. Research assistance from Sam Adams. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.